Thank you, Prachi, and welcome, friends. In my perhaps simplistic mind, I've always seen the universe as having two realms. The imagination and all that stuff that happens internally, and then that physical stuff out there that our body bumps into. And in this simplistic understanding, the role of science is to help sort of match the realities of those two universes and to lubricate the interface in between. In 1961, John Kennedy wanted to send a man to the moon, and his science advisor said, "There is no scientific reason to send a human. We can just send some machinery." And so, you know, if you say that we're doing this for science, we won't back you. And Kennedy never, never in public said, "We're going to the moon to advance science." A little bit later, Gerald Ford called in the director of the EPA, and he said, "I know that you're about to regulate auto emissions for the first time. You know, you're the scientist. You need to decide what's going to be regulated, what the limits are going to be. I just want to be informed in advance of what you're going to do." Can you imagine today the president calling in the head of the FDA or calling in the head of the EPA and saying, "Okay, you're the scientist, so you're going to decide whether or not we're going to regulate tobacco or whether or not we're going to, for example, have regulations on carbon emissions. I just want to be informed in advance." That's a laughable notion. In just 30 years, the standing of science as it directs our public policy has diminished immensely. And I think it all began with Newt Gingrich and his little Republican Revolution in 1994. When he took control of the Congress, he did away with something called the Office of Science and Technology. And the purpose of this office was to be a neutral, nonpartisan voice to evaluate technical things that came in front of the Congress. And so after doing away with it, instead of, for example, having this neutral body decide, is there global warming going on, instead they would have a hearing. And they would invite someone, maybe the president of the National Academy of Science, and he'd come and he'd make his little spiel. "Well, every journal article ever published in the peer-reviewed literature says the globe is warming." And then they'd have someone else testify. Maybe he'd be a representative of the oil companies. And he'd say, "You know, some of our data show that certain places are actually getting cooler." And at the end of the hearing, the senators and congressmen could say, "Well, there's no consensus in the science. It's very confusing. We need more information." Or even worse, when it's something, for example, like the overwhelming evidence that abstinence programs cause young women to get pregnant. If you've taken a pledge of abstinence, you're not going to go carrying a condom around, so it alters your protective behaviors. They'll just deny it. They'll say, "Oh, no, that's not true," and move on, in spite of unanimity among scientists on that subject. And I encountered this myself in 2004, when I went to Iraq. I did a study with some colleagues from a university in Baghdad, and a group of us from Columbia and Johns Hopkins and El Mustansadia University published a study saying three things. Since the 2003 invasion of Iraq, the rate of violent deaths has gone up 58-fold. We only went to one place in Anbar province by random luck when we picked our neighborhoods to visit. And in that one place, in the city of Fallujah, a third of the people were dead. And then we went to 32 other randomly picked neighborhoods, and in those, a tiny fraction, maybe 1% more than expected, were dead. In those other 32 neighborhoods, our best guess was about 100,000 people had died. When we took the other two factors into account, we reported it as at least around 100,000 have died. That was actually our mistake. "At least around" sounds like we don't know what we're talking about. And The day after it came out, two spin pieces were written, one by a former Undersecretary of Defense, the other by the Slate magazine defense correspondent, and they both essentially had the same line. Wow, more power to these guys sneaking around in Iraq, measuring deaths. But look at how imprecise this is. They ignore that Fallujah and violence part. They just said, well, you know, if you look at those other 32 neighborhoods, they're only 97% sure it's over 8,000 and only 90% sure it's over 44,000. So they don't know what they're talking about. It's so imprecise as to be meaningless. And this message, so imprecise as to be meaningless, spread through the blogosphere with amazing speed. Study came out on a Thursday. A couple of friends told me that on the Sunday, their minister from the pulpit said, the Lancet study claiming 100,000 civilian deaths in Iraq has been proved to be flawed and wrong. The Monday after, I got a call from a reporter in Chicago who said, you know, I just called up a couple of right-to-life groups and said, if you care about life so much, how do you feel about 100,000 dead Iraqis? And one of them said, well, I heard it might only be 8,000. The Tuesday after, my next-door neighbor was listening to the shock jock radio and heard that the Lancet study reporting 8,000 deaths has been proved to be flawed and wrong. And it just got no traction in this country in spite of being on the front page of every European and Middle Eastern newspaper. So last summer, we repeated this process. We went to twice as many places. We had twice the period of war, so our statistical power was much greater. We came out with a study saying we think about 650,000 people have died above the rate at which they were dying during Saddam's last year. And the vast majority, 90%, is from violence. Well, this time, those same two critics were the same critics again. This time, the imprecision wasn't the issue. Now they don't like the methods, even though this is the standard way by which this is done. It's how the U.S. did it after the war in Kosovo. It's how the U.S. just recently did it in Afghanistan. The U.S. government spends millions of dollars teaching various people, NGO workers, UN workers, how to employ this method, but nonetheless, they didn't like it. And the spin has just been shocking. There was an op-ed written in the Wall Street Journal with someone that I had spoken to that said, this is not valid. They didn't collect any demographic data. Not only did I tell him that we collected the age and gender of everyone in all the houses, births and deaths, which I consider demographic data, but we also had an email exchange in which I said that to him, and it was in the methods of the article. So he just made it up. He just made it up because he didn't like the result. Of all the scientific studies that have come out in recent years that have been coined as controversial, whether Dolly the sheep was really cloned, whether or not the University of Utah really did cold fusion, this has got to be the easiest one to refute or verify. If President Bush and a group in England that monitor newspaper reports called Iraqi Body Count, if they're correct that as of last December, 30,000 had died, now it's 40-something thousand have died in Iraq as a result of the invasion, in Iraq, even if it's the healthiest country in the world, there have to be about 140,000 deaths a year from just natural causes. People die. 26 million, 27 million people have a lot of deaths. So if they're right, only 1 in 10 deaths over the last 3 years in Iraq has been from violence. If we're right, if over the last 3.5 years have been about 500,000 natural deaths and 600 and something thousand violent deaths, then when you go to the morgues or graveyards, most of the deaths over the last 3 years must have been from violence, as we see in the Baghdad morgue. Imagine we came out with a study that said, we think the average person in America has a pulse rate of 10 beats per minute. You know, even if most of you aren't scientists, my guess is you'd sort of pull out your wrist and you'd put a finger there and you'd talk to a couple of your neighbors. You might think that people are really tense in New York, so make a couple phone calls out west. And I think it wouldn't take you very long to realize that this study's way out of whack. bless you. The difference between one death in 10 and most deaths is outrageously easy to determine. And here we are 3 weeks after our study has come out, and no one in the press, no one in the UN has bothered to go out and decide which of these two figures that differ by a factor of 10 is in the right ballpark. I went as an undergraduate to St. Lawrence University in the North Country of New York, and I worked at the library, and one day I was out tooling around on a Sunday with my boss, and she had been invited to have dinner at the house of the host of the local public radio station. Her name was Martha Foley. When I was an undergraduate, she was really, really old. She was about 30. And my boss had been invited to dinner. I hadn't been. My boss said, oh, just come along. I was, 19 years old. I hadn't been invited. I was really uncomfortable. Oh, no, I can't. Oh, come on. So off I went. We rolled in, and we're walking up the driveway, and I see Martha Foley look out her kitchen window, and I see her walk over to the sideboard and grab a plate. We got closer to the door, and she somehow scooted to the door and greeted us. And when we stepped in, there was an extra place that had been set as if I was expected. And it was never mentioned that I hadn't been invited. And so when my wife and I are sort of chatting around the kitchen, we have this little expression, a Martha Foley moment, meaning invisible grace. So there I was in Iraq, 2004. It's near the end of our survey. And part of my routine in those days when I was cloistered in my hotel room with the furniture stacked against the door was that I would listen to the National Public Radio on the satellite radio every day. And I'm listening, and on the radio comes Martha Foley, the voice of invisible grace. And she's talking about, in September of 2004, picking blueberries in northern New York, in the North Country. And I look out the window, and these two helicopter gunships come up, and they're circling around something. And Martha Foley's talking about just how beautiful it is on this day. And she's out picking blueberries with her granddaughter. And these two gunships are just firing and firing around something. They're on opposite sides of a circle, going around and around, whatever it is they're shooting at. And pretty soon, 30, 40 seconds in, there's black smoke piling up, and they're probably only half a mile away, and so I can hear the cannon fire or machine guns or whatever it is, and I think I can see the casings falling down as they shoot. And she's talking about what a great year it's been for blueberries in the North Country and how they're going to have such a nice time when they get home making all these wonderful foods out of the blueberries. And, you know, there's a couple of guys in this helicopter gunship. They're going to soon be home at Thanksgiving dinner with their nephews on their knees. They're nice guys. And they're raining hell and misery down on some poor person in a way we can't even imagine. It's hard to imagine having your ears and your eyes capture such divergent human experiences at one moment. And that schizophrenia is America. Martha Foley and that gunner all went to high school with us. They are all part of who we are. And the role of science is to help each of those extremes develop some neutral language, some common ground, so that when something doesn't seem right in the view of the other, we can at least have some dialogue about it. If 650,000 people have died in Iraq, and President Bush stands by his estimate that 30,000 have died, we are driving a wedge between us and the Middle East. The press, who cover our story in the Middle East as if it's, and it is, the most logical and best information, and the press here that consistently only settle for the newspaper reports, are driving the world further and further apart. What an absurd thing that citation of a number of dead could be driving the world's understanding further and further apart. And worst of all, if we're right, at a moment when our nation desperately needs to be expressing contrition, our leaders are being downright belligerent. I think we all need a little more invisible grace, and we all need to encourage our leaders to be contrite at this moment when we have made such an obscene series of errors. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Roberts. 4 weeks ago, just after the Military Commissions Act of 2006 was signed by Congress, Bill Goodman explained to those of us who came together as an emergency response to what was known to us at the time as the new torture bill. Tonight, as the legal director of the Center for Constitutional Rights, he will fill out the picture, giving us an overview of how a police state is being pieced together rapidly under the Bush administration. I'm pleased to introduce People's Lawyer Bill Goodman.
Well, good evening, everybody. It's a pleasure to be here, and I want to congratulate The World Can't Wait for sponsoring this and a number of other events that I think call our attention to the grave crisis that we find ourselves in. About 791 years ago, anybody remember that? A bunch of guys who called themselves noblemen actually did something that was noble. They forced the King of England to put into written words a recognition of the, in the Magna Carta, of the writ of habeas corpus. Pretty much that right, which was constituted long before 1215, but written down in 1215, that right has remained intact and unharmed by this political regime here in the United States since the Constitution was enacted, with some exceptions, very limited and narrow exceptions over a few historic periods during the Civil War, immediately after Pearl Harbor in Hawaii, and one or two other times. Remained pretty much intact. 791 years later, a man who would not recognize nobility if it crawled out from under the rug and bit him on the nose, signed a statute called the Military Commissions Act that was a vast assault upon the right of habeas corpus. This one moment, this signing of this legislation, which he had engineered, which he had designed, which he had prepared for by planning the whole Guantanamo operation, wherein the idea of habeas corpus was first attempted to be banished and now finally banished. The courts will decide whether or not it's constitutional. This moment, I think, recognized and emblemized what this administration is all about. If you basically wanted to just identify those rights that constitute democracy in the world, those things that we recognize as creating something that we call a democracy, there are not that many of them. They're a small handful. We can identify them as I stand right here. Number one is that people who live in this community, in the society, in the nation, in the country, whatever it is, vote, that their votes are counted equally, that the voting process is transparent, and that whoever they vote for by a majority then has governmental power. That's one right. Another right is that the government simply can't arrest people without having a reason for doing it, without what we call probable cause in the Constitution of the United States. That right has been shredded as well, as has the right to vote. Another right is that you can't hurt people, you can't torture people, you can't kill people without due process of law, without a hearing, without a fair attempt to decide whether or not the infliction of punishment is fair or not. That's another basic right. Another one is that you can't discriminate against people based upon their race, based upon their religion, based upon their ethnicity, based upon these basic factors. This constitutes another right that we recognize as being a part of democracy. And finally, another right is the right of privacy, that you can't invade people's homes without a judge, without a warrant, and you cannot listen in on their telephone calls without a warrant. This is another right. And then in this country and many other democracies, we recognize the basic concept of separation of powers, of checks and balances, which is what the writ of habeas corpus is all about. This is a judge saying to the king, if you have no reason to have arrested this man or this woman, if you have no reason to hold them, if you don't have evidence, you have to let them go, and I'm ordering you to do it. That is checks and balances and separation of powers in action. Those are the basic concepts of a democratic society. Every one of them, from soup to nuts, has been under tremendous assault and in many cases tremendously diminished by this group of criminals who run the government called the United States government today. All you have to do is look at the docket, our docket at the Center for Constitutional Rights, to see this basic principle, in fact, in action. Immediately after 9/11, people were singled out and started disappearing from their communities and were held indefinitely and were beaten and were selected based upon the fact, first, that they were non-citizens of the United States, and second, that they were Muslims. They were either Arabs or they were South Asians. They were Muslim men. And this happened to thousands of people, and they were held in our communities. They were held at the Patterson County Jail the Passaic County Jail in Patterson, excuse me. They were held at the Metropolitan Detention Center in Brooklyn, New York. And this constituted the assault upon the idea that you can't discriminate, you can't engage in racial stereotyping, you cannot beat and torture people as a matter of policy you cannot do these things without some kind of judicial oversight. Then shortly after, in early 2002, people were picked up and were held without any access to their families or lawyers, and the United States government denied them the right of any ability to go to court at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. We finally litigated that case, went all the way to the United States Supreme Court in a case called Rasul versus Bush. And now that we had won Rasul versus Bush, Congress of the United States, which I'm sad to say is in these days a spineless institution, overruled Rasul versus Bush, or attempted to overrule Rasul versus Bush, and said, no, there is no right of habeas corpus. There is no right to demand of the king or the Department of Defense or the President of the United States or the FBI or the CIA, tell us why you're holding this person. That right no longer exists. That is the basic core right in a democracy, in any democracy in the world today, and has been for hundreds of years. And without it, we are slaves. And that is what Congress did less than a month ago, or approximately a month ago, when it enacted the Military Commissions Act. And if you take a look at a man named Maher Arar, this is a man, another case at the Center for Constitutional Rights, a man who was traveling from Tunisia to Canada, where he lived, where he was a citizen, where he had a family, where he had a business. He was an engineer. And while he was changing planes at John F. Kennedy Airport here in New York, he was held, he was detained, he was taken to the Metropolitan Detention Center in Brooklyn, and finally, after 13 days, he was deported, and he begged, "Do not send me back to Syria, because I will be tortured there." And he was deported not to Canada, where his family was, where his business was, but back to Syria. He was held in a cell essentially the size of a grave, below ground. He was beaten with electric wires every day, severely and viciously, for almost a year. And finally, they concluded they had the wrong person. And he was beaten not only with the complicity of the United States government at the very highest levels, but he was beaten with their authorization, with their approval, with their knowledge, and with their mandate. And when Mr. Arar attempted to sue the United States government for what they had done to him, they responded as they respond in every case: "You cannot sue us. We are beyond the law. This is a matter of national security. This is a state secret. You cannot get to us." And this is what they say over and over again. Another example is a case called the Center for Constitutional Rights versus George W. Bush. This is a case in which we have challenged and raised the fact that the United States government, the President of the United States, has authorized wireless, warrantless wiretapping and electronic interception of email. And this program of warrantless wiretapping involves hundreds of thousands, perhaps millions of Americans. And this program of warrantless wiretapping is clearly in violation of a law that has already been passed by Congress, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, FISA. And it is a crime, and notwithstanding all of that, the government of the United States continues to say, we do not care what the law says. This is a matter of national security. This is the war against terrorism. We can do as we choose. Your democratic rights are unimportant. We have to win this war. So over and over and over again, we've seen the basic concepts, the basic constructs that make up what we used to think of as democracy in the United States, undermined, destroyed, and diminished by this group of people. It is time that they go. I agree. The world cannot wait. Thank you very much.
I just wanted to announce that the reminder that there's an index card in everybody's programs, and people should be thinking and writing down the questions. And there'll be ushers that will be present at the aisles, so you can hand the index cards to them when you're ready. The pro-life life movement's war against contraception and their goals to change the culture of sex across America has tremendous implications on what is at stake for a whole half of humanity. The pro-choice versus pro-life battle is no longer simply over abortion, it is far more encompassing. Today, the pro-choice movement is also fighting to protect our rights to use contraception and enjoy sex without facing life-altering consequences. On November 8th, the day after the elections, the Supreme Court, now packed by Bush's anti-abortion judges Roberts and Alito, will hear two related cases on a reactionary law passed by Congress in 2003. This will have tremendous impact on women's lives and society overall, and if upheld, it will codify into law non-scientific fictions about abortion. Our next speaker is the Vice President of the Institute for Reproductive Health Access at NARAL Pro-Choice New York. Her recent book, How the Pro-Choice Movement Saved America, Freedom, Politics, and War on Sex, describes the assault of the Christian right on abortion and contraception. I bring you Christina Page.
Thank you. Just going to open my water. So I'll start by a couple of widely held misconceptions. First, President Bush is pro-life. False. Second, that the pro-life movement is interested in preventing abortion. Not true. You see, when President Bill Clinton presided over the most dramatic decline in abortion rates in the recorded history of our country, the Right to Life movement didn't send him any thank you notes. After witnessing how policies that furnished Americans with greater access to contraception led to fewer abortions being sought, the Bush administration decided on the very opposite approach. Why? Because the policies that lead to dramatic declines in abortion are offensive to the Right to Life movement, and in turn, Bush. Today, there is not one pro-life organization in the United States that supports the use of birth control. Rather, stripping people of the right to plan a family, rolling back access to contraception, has become a foundation of the pro-life agenda. The war against contraception in the United States is well underway, well financed, and thanks to the Bush administration and its steamy embrace of the pro-life movement, the war against family planning has racked up some important victories. Let me underscore something for you. We know what works to prevent unintended pregnancy. What most people don't know, but should, is that the countries with the lowest abortion rates in the world are the ones that have enacted the strongest pro-choice policies, like Sweden, Norway, and the Netherlands. You would think that for the honest pro-lifer, this should be of interest. More concerning, however, is that the agenda they insist upon has only proven to fail. Why is it that the countries with the highest abortion rates in the world are the ones that have enacted the strictest pro-life policies, the very strategies proposed by the U.S. pro-life movement and currently being executed by the Bush administration? Take abstinence only. We've routed over $1 billion in federal funding to abstinence-only programs. Interestingly, Sweden threw out these programs over 30 years ago, citing their dismal results. But after implementing comprehensive sex ed programs, Sweden enjoyed a 70% decline in teenage pregnancy. We don't even need 30 years of data to prove to us what works. Let's just look at the results of when Bush was governor and invested unprecedented sums in abstinence only in Texas. The result? Texas scored dead last in the nation, 50th out of 50 in the decline of teen births. And while the rest of the nation enjoyed dramatic declines in teen pregnancy, by the end of Bush's term as governor, Texas had one of the highest teen pregnancy rates in the country, exceeded by only four other states, including Florida, which his brother governed using the same approach. When Bush became president, he boldly took the dead last approach and prescribed it for the rest of the nation. Again, the steamy relationship Bush has with his pro-life base is a lucrative one, too. One in four federal dollars for abstinence-only money goes to pro-life groups. And probably the greatest reason these programs fail is because those designing them are not interested in reducing teen pregnancy. They are interested in proselytizing to children about their God. Take the virginity pledge programs. One called the Silver Ring thing got over $1 million in federal funding. Its executive director explained, "We're not really putting our energy into abstinence as much as we're putting it into faith. Abstinence is the tool that we're using to reach children." So it should come as no surprise that when Columbia and Yale researchers studied kids in these virginity pledge programs and compared them to kids not in the virginity pledge programs, that the virgin pledgers had the same rate of STDs as non-pledgers, the only difference being that virgin pledgers were 6 times more likely to have oral sex. Male virgin pledgers were 4 times more likely to have anal sex. The virgin pledgers were also less likely to use a condom, more likely to spread STDs. They have because they don't get treated for them. The pro-life movement has found a friend in George Bush because they share a disdain for science, information, evidence, proof, truth. When the pro-life movement asked Bush to appoint an abstinence-only ideologue to oversee the nation's contraception program to the poor, Bush said yes. We now see that the poorest Americans among us are seeking out abortion services more. When the Right to Life movement asked Bush to cut contraceptive benefits to federal employees, Bush said sure. When the Right to Life movement asked him to appoint an anti-contraception fanatic to the expert panel that approves contraceptives in the FDA, he said, "I will." And that choice led the FDA, our nation's premier scientific agency, to make its first ideological, religious decision in its history by denying the over-counter application for emergency contraceptives. When asked whether the president supports birth control, his spokesman dodged, only willing to say, "The president supports a culture of life." When the pro-life movement asked Bush to defund the UN agency that provides contraception to people living in the poorest nations on Earth, the places where family planning is nothing less than a life-saving technology, Bush said, "Where do I sign?" The loss of $34 million, 12% of the agency's budget, led to worldwide 12 million more unintended pregnancies, 5 million more abortions, 374 infant deaths, 27,000 maternal deaths, and that's each year. A culture of life, pro-life. The facts say otherwise. Thank you.
Thank you, Christina. I just wanted to make an announcement. There is video being taken of this event, and starting later this evening for about a month, this teach-in will be webcasted through the World Can't Wait website. And we urge everyone, whether you're in this auditorium tonight or watching online, to organize others to watch this event so many thousands around the country and the world can see this. We're also making a DVD available this week of the same of this teach-in, and people should purchase that. You can find more information about the DVD on the website. With the program, we have also included a sign-up sheet, so you can sign up today with us to organize a house party so you can view this event. And their ushers, like I said before, they're present at the aisles, and you should give those sign-up sheets to them. And when you leave today, before you leave, we have tens and thousands of flyers that I have has a statement from World Can't Wait that people should take, and you know, ask people to get involved in World Can't Wait, because we need a movement of millions to actually stop what is happening. And you know, what we're hearing today is we need to take it out to people too. So the web streaming, the fact that we're having video here, and it's going to be going on WBAI. Speaking of the alternative media, I just wanted to acknowledge that what happened in Oaxaca a couple of days ago, Bradley Will, who is an indie media journalist, he was murdered by the paramilitary police as he was documenting the uprising by the people in Oaxaca. He got killed by the police along with two other people who were resisting this. And he was about 36 years old, and he had been documenting struggle in Latin America for a number of years. And he was very active in the East Village community organizing and many other things around this city. So I just wanted to acknowledge him and, you know, a lot of other people who, you know, continue to dedicate themselves to making media available for people. Next, I just wanted to bring somebody up who has been challenging and working really hard to put and, you know, working hard to bring this issue of global warming and to you know, work hard to stop it. Ted Glick, he's been a leading figure, and he's a leading figure in the Climate Crisis Coalition. He's spoken at several of World Can't Wait events, and he was part of the Bush Crimes Commission events that happened in last January. He spoke at the panel on attacks on global environment. And recently, just last Monday, he was arrested because he was at the main entrance of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, where he unfurled a banner which said, "Bush, let NOAA," which is National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, "let NOAA tell the truth." And because the NOAA has been consistently, along with Bush and Cheney, has been denying the seriousness of global warming and suppressing a lot of the stuff that scientists have been researching. So I wanted to bring him to say a couple of words about that and, Ted Glick, everybody.
Thanks a lot. I just got back actually from Washington. We put a ladder up and we climbed up 25 feet to a ledge overlooking the entrance to NOAA and unfurled this banner, and myself and Paul Berman, a 23-year-old climate activist in the D.C. area, we stayed there for 4 hours, and eventually the police came and took us down. We were arraigned this morning. We have a December 12th trial date. We've had several charges put against us. If we're convicted of all of them and sentenced the maximum, it's 5.5 years in prison. We hope that that doesn't happen, and we will be fighting it. But I'm glad to be here. I'm glad to be, again, part of this world, important World Can't Wait activity. The climate crisis is extremely real, and what's so important to understand is that the climate crisis is accelerating. Week after week, new scientific studies come out about what's happening, such as the fact that the Greenland ice sheet, which if all of it melts into the ocean, sea levels worldwide will rise 20 feet all over the world, that the ice melt for the Greenland ice sheet has tripled in the last 5 years. The Arctic sea ice, in 1 year, from 2004 to 2005, the permanent 10 feet or deeper sea ice, 14% of that permanent sea ice disappeared in 1 year. So the climate crisis is extremely real, extremely urgent, and that's why Paul and I, supported by a number of people and activists, we felt the importance of taking this additional step, this urgent step of drawing attention to what the Bush administration is doing by their suppression of the science, suppression of the truth, denial of what's happening, refusal to take action. The last thing I just want to say is that, however, a very hopeful sign, a hopeful development, is that there is an international grassroots movement that has been building over the last year and a half. Last year, on December 3rd, it was the first International Day of Climate Action. And during the time of a big United Nations climate change conference in Montreal, there were 20 countries around the world where actions happened, where somewhere in the neighborhood of 80,000 people demonstrated in these 20 countries last year. This Saturday is the second International Day of Climate Action. There are 48 countries this year where organizing is taking place, including in the United States. The November 4th is the day of action because there's another major UN climate conference in Nairobi, Kenya, happening from November 6th to the 17th. And I'm glad to say there will be an action here in New York City, as well as in New Jersey, as well as in at least 35 other places around the United States. People can find out more by going to www.climateusa.org, climateusa.org. Thanks again. Let's do it together. We have to be very serious about this fight. It's crucial what we're doing. Let's keep it going. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Ted Glick. We applaud people who are taking such heroic civil disobedience actions, and many others who've done that and continue to do that. Our next speaker is Larry Everest, who's the author of Oil, Power, and Empire, Iraq and the U.S. Global Agenda. Larry helped organize the 2005 and 2006 International Commission of Inquiry on Crimes Against Humanity by the Bush administration. And he's a contributor to Impeach, the president and the case against Bush and Cheney from Seven Stories Press. This is his book. It's available along with Christina's book on one of the tables in the back. Alan's putting up his hand. You can go over there after the event. Tonight he will talk about what has driven this war, what is happening in Iraq, and what we should do to stop it. So please welcome Larry Everest.
Thanks. The call to this teach-in begins with the words that the world is facing a grave emergency. I couldn't agree more, and I'd like to add that all the shocking things we've seen over the last 6 years, including the things other speakers have been talking about and will talk about tonight, are only the beginning of the horrors this regime has in store for us, unless it's driven from power. I don't think this is hyperbole or hysteria. I think it's based on a sober assessment of what the Bush agenda is all about and where it's taking us and the rest of the world. And tonight I'm going to talk about this in relation to Iraq. And my theme is going to be the whole conversation has to change. Obviously, more and more people are opposing the war, are unhappy about the war, don't particularly like the war. But unfortunately, most people still think that Iraq was a mistake. They don't understand the actual reasons that this war was launched. They think it's going so bad so fast because of blunders by Bush. They don't understand that the developments in Iraq are rooted in the very nature of the agenda that's being carried out there. And far too many people believe that there's still some sort of a legitimacy in the Bush's so-called war on terror. And flowing from all this, I don't think people understand the grave danger we're facing of escalation in the region, whether it be in Iraq, Iran, or other countries, and of ongoing war. So tonight, I want to talk about why I'm saying all this and how the conversation needs to change and needs to change dramatically. And I just want to mention that it's really stunning. One of the reasons that there's frankly so much ignorance and confusion about what's going on in Iraq and why this war was launched is that people are systematically lied to about all of this. I'm not saying that there aren't a lot of facts of different sorts that have come out in the media. There haven't been a lot of important and insightful and interesting books and articles written. There's a tremendous amount of this, but here we are in the political season, right before an election, when these kinds of issues are supposed to be debated so people can understand the truth and understand reality. And what did the New York Times say last week? It admitted that voters were not being educated because neither party was interested in telling the truth about Iraq. And I think that's very true. And tonight I'm very honored to be here with the other speakers and try to help change this sorry state of affairs. And I want to make four basic points in my talk tonight. The first point is why Iraq is not a diversion from the so-called war on terror. It epitomizes the war on terror, which is actually a war for empire. I want to talk about why the debacle and looming failure in Iraq is rooted, embedded, to use one of their favorite words, in the very nature of this war. I want to talk about why this looming defeat or disaster for the U.S., for the Bush regime, is not necessarily going to lead it to pack its bags and go home and simply withdraw, but there's a very big danger of it escalating. And I want to talk about why we can't oppose or stop this war by arguing over whether it's been competently led and whether or not there's a strategy for victory. So I want to begin with a thought-provoking statement that actually there is, in fact, no war on terror. There is a war waged under the rubric of a war on terror, but it's actually a war for greater empire. If you try to understand Iraq or Iran, Lebanon, even Afghanistan, by conceiving of it as some kind of a war on terror, it makes no sense at all. It makes perfect sense if you understand it as a war for greater empire, a product of the Bush regime neocon dream of a new world order and a new American century. I mean, my feeling is, I've written about the history of the United States in the Middle East. I feel the United States has been an imperialist power for a long time, 100 years. I think its actions have been driven by the dynamics and exigencies of global capitalism. I think it's acted that way in the Middle East for decades, including in Iraq. There's a horrific history of U.S. intervention in Iraq that most people are largely unaware of. But nonetheless, I also think that what the Bush regime has set out to do is a radical leap and departure even from those past strategies of empire. And I want to just give a very brief overview of how all this came about. It began with the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1991. And you had government strategists like Dick Cheney, Paul Wolfowitz, Scooter Libby, I think you probably have heard of these people, felt that the United States faced an unprecedented opportunity to extend its power around the world in whole new ways without fear of any superpower challenger. But it also faced a very great necessity to do so before new centers of power coalesced, before this window of opportunity closed, before the many problems besetting U.S. society overtook it. So beginning in 1991, they spent a decade fighting for and devising this strategy with the aim of creating something that's never existed in history, an empire that's both unchallenged and unchallengeable. How do you set about doing something like this? Their first argument was that you prevent the rise. You don't like dealing with rivals? Don't let any emerge. How do you do that? Through preemptive war, even preventive war, before any can begin to threaten you. And I want to say that this is something that is not often discussed, but the fact of the matter is that the Bush administration is now behind the scenes carrying out this strategy against Russia and China. And tensions are increasing between these countries because they understand full well what the Bush administration's about. Another thing that you try to do is seize control of the world's strategic areas and resources, globalization at gunpoint, I call it. And you also proceed by trying to crush any and all who stand in your way, whether states or movements, whether Islamist movement, nationalist movements, revolutionary movements, communist movements, whatever. Paint them with the brush of terrorism, no matter what their politics are. So when they talk about World War III, they're very serious about this. This indeed is how they see it. And I just want to mention that now, at the moment, a big focus, and Bush and Cheney have been speaking about this lately, a big focus of this war is against Islamist states and opposition movements. And the problem that Bush and company have with these movements, and of course these are diverse movements, so I'm not trying to characterize all of them, but the problem that Bush and Cheney and company have with these movements is not mainly their fundamentalism or their use of terror. After all, the United States has been quite comfortable supporting fundamentalism and terrorism for decades and employing it, as Dr. Les Roberts indicated in his talk, on a massive, unbelievable scale in Iraq today. Nor is the question any sort of an immediate military threat in the ways that's being talked about to the United States. The problem Bush and company have with these forces is they're an impediment to their domination of the Middle East. So once you understand this global strategy, you understand what happened after September 11th. You understand that the Bush administration seized on this moment to launch an agenda it had been preparing for over a decade. You understand why it attacked Afghanistan, not mainly to find Osama bin Laden, who for some reason they still can't find, but to control a strategic country at the heart of Central Asia. And I know that a lot of people in the anti-war movement felt the Afghan war was somehow justified, and I think people should think hard about this in light of what's happened with Afghanistan, just the people there suffering enormously at being turned into the opium capital of the entire planet, being run by fascist warlords. Even the Taliban looks good to some people in Afghanistan at this point. This is also the reason why hours after September 11th, knowing full well that Saddam Hussein was not involved, as Richard Clark has told us, that Don Rumsfeld turned to an aide and said, begin preparing for war on Iraq. Go massive, sweep it all up, things related to September 11th and not. So Iraq was never a diversion from this so-called war on terror. It epitomized what this war was all about. They saw Iraq not as a central front on a war on terror, but a key piece on the global chessboard of empire. Remove Hussein and you've knocked a troublesome piece off the board. You've seized control of a central square. You've opened up new lines of attack. And let's be real here. You cannot control the world without controlling global energy, and you cannot control global petroleum and natural gas without controlling the Middle East and Central Asia, where 80% of it lies. And you know, some of you may know this, but the first acronym for the invasion of Iraq was Operation Iraqi Liberation. Of course, someone then realized that acronym spells OIL, so they thought better of it. So again, this war was not the product of an intelligence failure. Actually, their intelligence that Saddam Hussein had few, if any, weapons was quite good. The war and the whole doctrine that spawned it, a strategic doctrine it's based on, were illegal, immoral, and unjust from the beginning. They weren't mistakes, they were crimes. And one of the most controversial statements in the call for the world can't wait, which I hope everybody has and will read, is this point where it says that the Bush administration has tried to remake society in a fascist way for decades to come. And when I'm talking about the war component, isn't the whole thing, but it's a big part of why this is the fact. What about the occupation? A lot of people felt, well, I didn't like the war, but now that we're there, we should do something positive. But can it just occupation come from an unjust war? Can I have a show of hands, please, here? The Bush administration was never trying to bring liberation or democracy to Iraq. It was trying to bring imperialism. They invaded Iraq to turn it into a client state and a launching pad for other aggression in the Middle East. They did it to try to intimidate anti-U.S. movements across the region, including the Palestinians, to crush the Palestinian struggle and strengthen Israel as a regional gendarme. They did it to shock and awe the world. And if you don't believe me, just read the things they were saying in the Wall Street Journal and the Weekly Standard and the pages of Foreign Policy to justify and argue in favor of the war. It's all there. But as we're seeing now, grand ambitions are one thing, and realizing them is quite another. And again, there's been a whole spate of books that have come out, very interesting stuff on the arrogance, the blunders, the idiocy, the errors, and so on, that went with this occupation and why life is just a complete nightmare for the Iraqi people at this point. But I think we have to look more deeply. The reasons the occupation has turned into such a nightmare is because of the nature of it as an unjust imperial occupation. Why did the U.S. disband the Ba'ath Party and the Iraqi army, alienating the Sunni population and opening the floodgates of chaos in Iraq? Because they had a conscious strategy of crushing Arab nationalism and remaking the entire Iraqi state. This was not some off-the-cuff decision. This was part of their strategy. Why didn't they bring in more troops? Which, people don't point this out, but it's actually a war crime if you're an occupying force not to have requisite forces to maintain public safety and order. This is a war crime. But why didn't they have enough troops? Because they saw Iraq. Not only did they have contempt for the Iraqi people and a long history of resistance to foreign domination, they envisioned Iraq as merely phase two in a global war, and the last thing they wanted in the world was to have 500,000, 600,000 troops tied down in Iraq when they had so many other targets in sight. And the staggering and largely unreported violence, and again, I just think it was so courageous of the John Lester Less and the Johns Hopkins and the Iraqi people who worked on this study to open a window into the unprecedented violence that's been inflicted on the people of Iraq, unjust violence. And as often is the case, what happens when unjust violence is inflicted on a people? They resist and they rebel, and that's what many, many Iraqis are doing today. I think that the Bush regime is kind of facing that predicament defined or described in an old song by The Clash. Should I stay or should I go? If I stay, there will be trouble. If I go, there will be double. And that's what they're faced with from an imperialist perspective. A lot of people don't think the U.S. can continue this war, and many different outcomes here are possible, and it's quite possible there'll be changes in tactics and strategy. But if you understand the centrality of Iraq to their entire global agenda and their entire vision of the U.S. as a dominant imperialist power for decades to come, you realize that they are not going to easily give this up. And you realize there's a real danger of escalation. You've got to look at the Bush crew as gamblers who've gambled the future of U.S. global power on this war of empire that they're waging and on Iraq in particular. And what do compulsive gamblers do when faced with long odds? Double down. Escalate, escape forward. And there's a real danger that this is going to happen, particularly in regards to Iran. I think Chris is going to talk a bit about this later. Just today, you can read about naval maneuvers in the Straits of Hormuz. Seymour Hersh, I'm sure you're aware of his writings. So what do we do about this? How do we stop this? Well, one way we don't stop it is arguing that the war ought to be carried out more competently, or that we need a real strategy for victory. But that is exactly how this is being argued in these elections. John Kerry: Bush has a standstill and lose policy in Iraq. Hillary Clinton: the administration has lost focus on winning the war on Iraq. Can you imagine in the Vietnam War period if we had tried to stop that war by raising the slogan that Nixon wasn't militant enough and didn't have a strategy for victory? There would have been no anti-war movement, and this is one reason why there's not nearly enough of an outcry against this war today. The Democrats, you know, I know they're anti-war Democrats, but the Democratic leadership and the candidates they're running now criticize the war's execution, but how many of them say this is unjust and immoral? How many of them expose the actual nature of this war? How many of them condemn the idea that the U.S. somehow has the right to wage this unbounded war against whomever it deems a so-called terrorist, using massive terror all the way along, so that the United States can occupy a privileged position in the world and maintain a situation where 20% of the world's population in the industrialized world, particularly the United States, consumes 80% of the wealth. I don't want to be part of that enterprise. I don't want to be part of a new Rome. I don't want to live a... I don't want to live a privileged existence with the illusion of safety, or maybe even some safety, whatever, on the blood and bones of people in Iraq and Palestine and Lebanon. And other places. And you know, it was interesting because Frank Rich in the Times the other day wrote that during Vietnam, by 1971, 51% of the people thought the Vietnam War was immoral. And today, 58% of the people think the Iraq War was a mistake. But he treated them, you know, and I like a lot of his writing, I mean, but he treated them as if those are the same things. They're profoundly different. It is very different to think of a war as being immoral and unjust versus it was an error. We've got to change those statistics, so 58% think it is immoral and unjust. Then we'll have an anti-war movement in this country. And I also think we need to confront the fact that neither party, Democrat or Republican, is an anti-war party. It's on us to stop this. And I just want to conclude by saying that we need to demand that the U.S. leave Iraq now. For 3 years, the Bush administration and its various supporters have been saying, if we left Iraq, there'd be chaos. People would die and suffer. Every day the United States is staying there, it gets worse. And it gets worse because it's pursuing the agenda that I'm describing, including unleashing sectarian violence and helping organize death squads and the most vicious kind of violence against people. I've been in Iraq. It was not always that way. For whatever problems there were, and there were many, and I'm not a defender of Saddam Hussein, the U.S. has managed to make things worse. And I'm not going to pretend that things would be fine if the U.S. left, but continuing the occupation would be a nightmare for Iraqis. It would turn Iraq into a platform for further aggression, and it would embolden the Bush administration to take new adventures like this. There's nothing wrong with the Vietnam syndrome. Anyway, I just want to close with another little Vietnam story. I just think people, all of us here, have an enormous responsibility to change the situation And I firmly believe that even a minority of people armed with the truth can make a huge difference, particularly at times when the powers that be are split, when things are going badly, when the ground is changing very rapidly beneath our feet. These are times when a dedicated and determined minority that's willing to fight for its convictions and stand for the truth can change history. You know, Henry Kissinger, Clark claims he's not a relation, I'm not sure, but wrote in his memoirs that during Vietnam, the establishment was paralyzed and a tiny handful of radicals stepped into the vacuum and seized the political initiative. Well, I'm proud to count myself as one of those radicals, and I bet there are a lot of people here tonight that were also part of that. And my slogan is, let's do it again.
Thank you, Larry. I just wanted to give our thanks to the Church of St. John the Divine for providing the space for us. So please. Next, I want to bring you Deborah Sweet, who's the national coordinator of the World Can't Wait Drive Out the Bush Regime movement. She's an incredibly important and needed leader at times like these. Her incredible foresight and calm and continuous dedication has made her an anchor for this whole movement. And to reiterate again, as a call for the World Can't Wait Drive Out the Bush Regime states, the Bush regime is setting out to radically remake society very quickly in a fascist way and for generations to come. Deborah Sweet will speak to the responsibility each of us has to act on now, because the future is in balance. Thank you.
Okay, it's time for the audience participation section of the program. And I'm also talking to you on the World Wide Web, wherever you are tonight, because we're starting to broadcast live around the world right now. I want to give all of our volunteers and ushers some exercise with your baskets. There's two things to put in those baskets. One are your questions. They're going to collect more questions so that we can sort through and organize them and have a great question and answer session. And the second thing is we will take your credit card pledges, your checks, your $1,000 bills, your $500 bills, your $100 bills, your 50s, your 20s. And on the internet, you can go right to worldcantwait.org and find as well how to donate, because the expenses tonight for providing this to the world are $15,000. Now I want to tell you some stories while you're getting out your funds. In the wake of the protests that we held around the country, 230-some protests this month, we held important meetings to assess and find out what people were thinking. Among other things, why did less people come out to protest than many of us expected? In the wake of these protests, we've dug deep into a conversation over what it's going to take to drive out this regime. And I want to bring you some stories of what we learned from some of these meetings. A man in Chicago told us that his friends tell him that he is overplaying the situation. They hate George Bush, but they've decided long ago that nothing can be done and all we can do is wait until 2008. He challenges them, saying, it's not that Bush is stupid, which he is. It's not that Bush is incompetent, which he also is. Bush is a war criminal. At a meeting in San Francisco, an older man said, there's a wall of denial affecting all walks of life in this country about what is happening and where this is headed. People don't understand that the Bush regime represents is not the goal. It's just the beginning of where they're going with this society. And third, a teacher got involved after reading worldcan'twait.org for 6 months. He said that one of the things that kept him from being involved sooner, something he's had to come to grips with, is that since things are as serious as World Can't Wait says they are, once you become involved, it would change your whole life. He said a lot of people he knows don't know the momentous and sweeping changes that are going on, mainly because of the lies of the government and the media. Some think that they have some idea, but they don't really know in depth, for example, about the torture bill. But there are also those who do know, or who have a strong inkling of what is going on and have increasingly consciously made the choice not to oppose what is going on, because they think they themselves are not going to be affected, and they do not want their lives to be disrupted. And maybe they even think it's okay for these others to be hurt if it will make them safer. He thinks many of his co-workers who are teachers think this way. These are the kind of people who know torture is wrong, but they don't speak out because it's being done to Muslims, not to them. He thinks that these people are wrong on both a moral level and because in reality they are not at all safe from the same kind of treatment Muslims are getting if it becomes expedient or necessary for the government. He says that one of the missions World Can't Wait should have is to put before the entire nation the choice of whether or not to drive out the Bush regime. Everyone must know the situation and know there are people trying to change it and that they must each make a choice. And it's true, our call says that the Bush regime is remaking society very quickly in a fascist way and for generations to come. And this is not rhetoric designed to shock people into protesting one policy or decision or another that they don't like. It's actually an assessment of what's happening in this society if we don't stop it. And this is a movement that is not content to just register protest. We are serious when we say that the mission before us is to challenge the outcome of history in our time. And a lot of people tell us that we're going to have to wait until everyone is affected. Wait until there's a draft or something that will make people really care. I'm also a child of the 60s, and I was involved in the anti-war movement, and I remember very well that a lot of us protested the war because it was morally wrong, just as Larry was talking about, not because we were personally affected by the draft. And there are some other reasons and other historical lessons that we should heed besides that. The trouble with not acting until it affects you is best captured by the famous quote by Pastor Martin Niemöller, where he said, "First they came for the communists, and I didn't speak up because I wasn't a communist. And then they came for the Jews, and I was a Protestant, so I didn't speak up. And then so on and so forth. They came for other groups of people. And then when they came for me, there was no one left to speak up." We cannot heed that lesson too sharply at this moment. We just heard Bill Goodman talk about the Military Commissions Act. Many people do not know what we just heard. 900 years of legal precedence demolishing the right of habeas corpus. This will affect all of the society we're living in. But many people still don't know how it will affect them. This is the main reason that we are sponsoring this teach-in tonight and spreading it around the world. And this has to happen urgently all across the country. Tonight we're presenting the major features of the whole package being hammered into place that are transforming this country domestically and its relationship with the people of the rest of the world. The disconnect between the enormity of what the Bush administration is forcing through and the lack of resistance from people in this country is what shocks the world. As we said in our New York Times ad about the torture bill, silence plus torture equals complicity. If you have the basis to know about, but refuse to recognize or acknowledge the terrible acts your government under the current regime is committing in the Middle East and other parts of the world, as well as within the U.S. itself, if you do recognize and acknowledge the great harm your government is doing, but you do not act in a meaningful way to oppose this, then yes, you are complicit in these crimes. Many people are hoping right now that a Democratic victory in the midterms or in 2008 will somehow stop this. But the political terms of the election and the political discourse in this country is seriously disconnected from what's actually going on and what millions of people are trying to register with their votes. Even if the Democrats win, if this is done by electing right-wing Democrats who promise to be the strongest on national security and conducting the war on terror, who oppose abortion and gay marriage, who support prayer in school, as several prominent Democratic senatorial candidates do, where will we be? Farther from stopping this whole juggernaut. There is not going to be some savior from the Democratic Party. This whole idea of putting our hopes and energies into leaders who tell us to seek common ground with fascist and religious fanatics is proving every day to be a disaster and actually serves to demobilize people. I'm old enough to remember that we were told to vote for LBJ, Lyndon Johnson, because he would end the war. What does it tell you that right now there is no leading Democratic voice opposing an attack on Iran? It is up to us. We have to change the political discourse in this country, turning it inside out and right side up, with massive society-wide resistance. The people, we, can set radically different terms, ones that value human life, whether it's American or not. Terms that uphold critical thinking and dissent, that believe in science and reason and the separation of church and state, that believes and advances the concept of equality for women and different nationalities, that is opposed to all forms of discrimination, that believes we should protect the tenuous existence of this planet so we can pass it on to future generations, that even restores due process. The world really cannot wait. Only we can stop this in our millions through independent action to create a political situation where George Bush himself is forced to leave office and where his whole program of the regime is decisively repudiated. Starting tonight, and across the country, World Can't Wait, Drive Out the Bush Regime is organizing thousands of people through Election Day next Tuesday in a very visible effort to challenge the terms of this election with a flyer available here and online at worldcantwait.org. We have thousands of flyers. Everything the Bush regime is doing is intolerable. 2008 is too late. The world can't wait. Let's blanket the farmers markets, the yoga studios, the laundromats, the schools, the workplaces, the coffee shops, and the street corners. And let's get this flyer out to the polls. I want you to remember to stand the requisite number of feet from the polling station. Everyone in this hall can take home sackfuls of these flyers and get them out, and you on the internet can download them at worldcantwait.org. Expenses for this teach-in, as I said, are $15,000. It's going to make available an immediate DVD that can be spread all over the world. The downloaded webcast is going to be available for a month. All of this done so that people can know what we know in this room and can go out and act on it, because people act on what they know. I want you to dig deep right now wherever you are. Your pledges and checks for $1,000, $500, $100, your $20 bills, your credit cards, and your checks. All the information on how to give is available to you here in this hall and online at worldcantwait.org. The world can't wait. Drive out the Bush regime. Thank you.
Just a quick announcement for the New York folks. The New York City local chapter is meeting this Thursday at 6 p.m. at the offices of 1199. It's on West 43rd Street between 8th and 9th Avenue. So tell everybody else and to be there. And it's the offices of 1199. And it's on West 43rd Street between 8th and 9th Avenue. When you go there, 310, okay. It's 6 p.m. A theocratic agenda is woven through every aspect of the Bush regime. A biblically literalist ideology are influencing domestic policy, education, war, women's lives, culture, who gets audited and who doesn't, legal access to divorce, and at the most international scale, the war in Iraq, fueling of the war in Lebanon, and the impending war in Iran. You may remember Chris Hedges as a reporter for the New York Times in the Middle East. He's the author of War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning and Losing Moses on the Freeway. Chris is currently a senior fellow at the Nation Institute. Today, he will address the moves towards theocracy and its influence on the threatening moves towards a war on Iran. Please welcome Chris Hedges. Thank you.
Thank you very much. As I speak to you tonight, the aircraft carrier Eisenhower, accompanied by the guided missile cruiser USS Anzio, guided missile destroyer USS Ramage, guided missile destroyer USS Mason, and the fast attack submarine US Newport News, are arriving in the Straits of Hormuz off of Iran. The ships will be in place to strike Iran by the end of the month. It may be a bluff, it may be a feint, it may be a simple show of American power, but I doubt it. The chances of a war with Iran, a war that would unleash an apocalyptic scenario in the Middle East, are not only real but probable by the end of the Bush administration. It could begin in as little as a few weeks. This administration, claiming to be anointed by a Christian God to reshape the world and especially the Middle East, defined three key states at the start of its reign as the axis of evil. They were Iraq, now occupied, North Korea, which because it has nuclear weapons is untouchable, and Iran. Those who do not take this apocalyptic rhetoric seriously have ignored the twisted pathology of men like Elliot Abrams, who helped orchestrate the disastrous and illegal Contra war in Nicaragua, and who now handles the Middle East for the National Security Council. He knew nothing about Central America. He knows nothing about the Middle East. He sees the world through the childish, binary lens of good and evil, us and them, forces of darkness and forces of light. And it is this strange twilight mentality that now grips most of the civilian planners who are barreling us towards a crisis of epic proportions. These men advocate a doctrine of permanent war, a doctrine which is a slight corruption of Leon Trotsky's doctrine of permanent revolution. These two revolutionary doctrines serve the same function, to intimidate and destroy all those classified as foreign opponents, to create permanent instability and fear, and to silence domestic critics who challenge leaders in a time of national crisis. And it works. The citizens of the United States are slowly being stripped of their civil liberties, are being herded sheep-like once again over the cliff. But this war will be different. It will be catastrophic. It will usher in the apocalyptic nightmares spun out in the dark, fantastic visions of the Christian right. And there are those around the president, including perhaps the president himself, who see this vision as preordained by God. We live, to borrow a line from Immanuel Kant, in an age of radical evil, an age of death. Dr. James Luther Adams, my ethics professor at Harvard Divinity School, told us that when we were his age, and he was then close to 80, we would all be fighting the Christian fascists. The warning given to me 25 years ago came at the moment Pat Robertson and other radio and televangelists began speaking about a new political religion that would direct its efforts at taking control of all institutions, including mainstream denominations and the government. Its stated goal was to use the United States to create a global Christian empire. It was hard at the time to take such fantastic rhetoric seriously, especially given the buffoonish quality of those who expounded it. But Adams warned us against the blindness caused by intellectual snobbery. The Nazis, he said, were not going to return with swastikas and brown shirts. Their ideological inheritors had found a mask for fascism in patriotism and the pages of the Bible. Adams was not a man to use the word fascist lightly. He was in Germany in 1935 and 1936 and worked with the underground anti-Nazi church known as the Confessing Church, led by Dietrich Bonhoeffer. Adams was eventually detained and interrogated by the Gestapo, who suggested he might want to consider returning to the United States. It was a suggestion he followed. He left on a night train with framed portraits of Adolf Hitler placed over the contents inside his suitcase to hide the rolls of home movie film he took of the so-called German Christian Church, which was pro-Nazi, and the few individuals who defied them, including the theologians Karl Barth and Albert Schweitzer. The ruse worked when the border police lifted the top of the suitcases, saw the portraits of the Führer, and closed them up again. I watched hours of the grainy black and white films as he narrated in his apartment in Cambridge. He saw in the Christian right, long before we did, disturbing similarities with the German Christian Church and the Nazi Party. Similarities that he said would, in the event of prolonged social instability or a national crisis, see American fascism, under the guise of religion, rise to dismantle the open society. And he despaired of liberals, who he said, as in Nazi Germany, mouthed silly platitudes about dialogue and inclusiveness that made them ineffectual and impotent. Liberals, he said, did not understand the power and allure of evil, nor the cold reality of how the world worked. And the current hand-wringing by Democrats, with many asking how they can reach out to a movement whose leaders brand them as demonic and satanic, would not have surprised Adams. Like Bonhoeffer, he did not believe that those who would fight effectively in coming times of turmoil, a fight that for him was an integral part of the biblical message, would come from the church or the liberal secular elite. His critique of the great prominent research universities along with the media, was no less withering. These institutions, self-absorbed, compromised by their close relationship with government and corporations, given enough of the pie to be complacent, were unwilling to deal with the fundamental moral questions and inequities of our age. They had no stomach for a battle that might cost them their prestige and comfort. He told me, I suspect half in jest, that if the Nazis took over America, 60% of the Harvard faculty would begin their lectures with the Nazi salute. But this, too, was not an abstraction. He had watched academics at the University of Heidelberg, including the philosopher Martin Heidegger, raise their arms stiffly to students before class. Adams also reminded us that American intellectuals and industrialists openly flirted with fascism in the 1930s. Mussolini's corporatism, which created an unchecked industrial and business aristocracy, appealed to many American industrialists at the time, who saw it as an effective counterweight to the New Deal. In 1934, Fortune magazine lavished praise on the Italian dictator for his defanging of labor unions and his empowerment of industrialists at the expense of workers. Adams, finally, told us to watch closely what the Christian right did to gays and lesbians. He had seen how the Nazis had used values to launch state repression of opponents. Hitler, days after he took power in 1933, imposed a ban on all homosexual and lesbian organizations. He ordered raids on places where homosexuals gathered, culminating with the ransacking of the Institute for Sexual Science in Berlin. Thousands of volumes from the Institute's library were tossed into a bonfire. Adams said that homosexuals would be the first deviants singled out by the Christian right. We would be the next. The ban on same-sex marriages, passed by 11 states in the last election, was part of this march towards our door. A 1996 federal law already defines marriage as between a man and a woman. All of the states with ballot measures, with the exception of Oregon, had outlawed same-sex marriages, as do 27 other states. The bans, however, had to be passed, believers were told, to thwart activist judges who wanted to overturn them. The Christian family, even the nation, was under threat. The bans served to widen the splits tearing apart the country. The attacks on homosexuals handed to the foot soldiers of the Christian right an easy target. It gave them a taste of victory. It made them feel empowered. But it is ominous for gays and for us. 2 decades later, even in the face of the growing reach of the Christian right, his prediction seems apocalyptic. And yet the power brokers in the Christian right have moved from the fringes of society to the executive branch, the House of Representatives, the Senate, and the courts. The movement has seized control of the Republican Party and now holds a majority of seats in 36% of all Republican Party state committees, or 18 of 50 states, along with large minorities in 81% of the rest of the states. 45 senators and 186 members of the House of Representatives earned between an 80 to 100% approval rating from the three most influential Christian right advocacy groups, the Christian Coalition, Eagle Forum, and Family Resource Council. The Election Day exit polls found that 22% of voters identified themselves as evangelical Christians, and Bush won 77% of the vote. The polls found that a plurality of voters said that the most important issue in the campaign had been moral values. The movement is today making a huge push to seize control of key states, including Ohio, where the Secretary of State, Ken Blackwell, has become the poster child for the movement. Blackwell, whose office refused to investigate the numerous allegations of fraud in the last presidential election, hardly a surprise, given that Blackwell was the co-chair of the Bush-Cheney campaign in Ohio. He has already eliminated some 500,000 voters from registration polls, rolls in Cincinnati, Columbus, Cleveland, and Toledo, and nearly all are in heavily urban areas that traditionally vote Democratic. The purge represents, at this point, nearly 10% of the 5.2 million voters of the last election. And as I speak, Blackwell is now imposing restrictive voter ID requirements that could limit tens of thousands of more voters from voting, mostly from poor and black neighborhoods. Blackwell is lauded and feted at rallies run by the Christian right, including a group called Patriot Pastors, who have adopted as their symbol the cross superimposed on an American flag. When I attended a rally in Dayton where Blackwell was present, a chorus sang militant hymns and patriotic songs while the crowd watched pictures of the war in Iraq. Blackwell must, as a political candidate, maintain the fiction of the separation of church and state, dodging his intent to build a theocratic Christian government, while at the same time sending out a stream of coded reassurances to his radical base. He has posted on his website, along with other members of the Christian right now in the political system, a list of 20 requirements for people of high character. He helped make Ohio a state of character, part of a movement within the Christian right that has spread to many other states as well as numerous cities and towns. He has put funding and resources aside to train citizens and leaders on how to be people of character. He sends out to all potential candidates forms to fill out to declare they are persons of character and posts the names of those who abide by the request on his website. But woven into the 20-point list, which deftly eschews all religious terminology, is a blueprint for an authoritarian state, one where questioning power is unpatriotic and only those with high character, as rigidly defined by Christians like Blackwell, have the right to lead and be heard. Individualism, the right to privacy, the belief that other political viewpoints and moral systems have value are all attacked as disruptive to social cohesion. In the section titled Unity, followers are told, high character people strive to build relationships that foster oneness among others who are bound with them to a common promise, vision, mission, or purpose. Ethical organizations seek uniformity in their people's shared character ethics and unity among their otherwise richly diverse people. Without a preserving commitment to shared character ethics, there is no hope for sustainable unity. In the section titled Accountability, it talks about how to enforce this unity. High character people scrutinize themselves and welcome the scrutiny of others. Ethical people acknowledge that human nature compels us toward independence. Our preference for independence results in isolation from one another. Isolation breeds temptation to unethical conduct. Ethical people resist this chain reaction by adopting transparent life and work styles that invite inspection. Ethical people place themselves in relationships that motivate self-examination and encourage constructive critique from others, particularly those they serve. Point 14, honoring authority, is a reminder that without moral guides, people of high character can go astray and deviate from the ethical standards imposed from above. All people are imperfect, it reads, requiring boundaries for behavior. High character people willingly yield to the authority of those who are charged with upholding those boundaries. Ethical people help shape and then abide by the legitimate laws, rules, and boundaries established by legitimate authorities and strive to live within those boundaries for the betterment of all people. When those given authority violate conscience-convicting ethics, ethical people take ethical action to restore ethical authority. And towards the end of the list, point 19, under a heading, Our Ability to Change, there is a section titled Submission to Truth. Truth transforms people only when we submit to it. Truly high-character people cannot not transform. Eventually, everyone ultimately confronts the power of truth. When confronted by the truth, ethical people are convicted to replace or put off their unethical behavior by pursuing and putting on ethical beliefs. Unethical people do not. This ongoing replacement lifestyle of ethical people produces the enduring evidence or proofs called virtues. All these points make, in essence, the same point. People of high character give over all authority for moral and political decisions to leaders who tell them what is true and what is right. All must, if they have high character, invite scrutiny by these leaders, by the organs of the state, and by their neighbors. These tenets are the cornerstone of the police state. The state where all are told to watch for social and political deviance, where there is only one orthodox truth, where all dissent is heresy, where people who are not of high character, people who do not submit and do what they are told, are not allowed to contaminate the public domain. Those of high character, those who abide by these moral tenets, become servile, afraid, bound to the tasks laid out by their leaders, willing to be punished for failing to achieve the moral standards and goals imposed by the state, and ready to denounce those around them. It is the antithesis of the message Jesus preached in the Gospels. President Bush must further these important objectives, including the march to turn education and social welfare over to the churches with his faith-based initiative, which has received hundreds of millions of dollars of taxpayer money, as well as chip away at the wall between church and state with his judicial appointments, if he does not want to face a revolt within his core constituency. Hope, Augustine wrote, has two beautiful daughters. Their names are anger and courage. Anger at the way things are, and courage to see that they do not remain the way they are. Anger, when directed against those who would abuse the weak, preach bigotry and injustice, trample on the poor, crush dissent, and impose a religious tyranny, is a blessing. Read the prophets. But because so many of our liberal institutions are bankrupt, bought off by corporate dollars, no longer willing to accept in religious terms that heretics exist, the goal is to appease the very people who openly call for our destruction. The liberal church stumbles along, muttering creeds they no longer believe, trying to peddle a fuzzy, feel-good theology that can distort and ignore the Bible as much as the Christian right. And the Christian right is not always wrong about liberals. In fact, the movement voices much of our most prescient social criticism. They at least understand the ills of American society, even as they use these ills to plunge us into tyranny. They grasp the hollowness, timidity, and hypocrisy of the liberal church. The Christian right attacks cultural relativism, a creed that there is no absolute good and all value systems have equal merit, even as they benefit in a final irony from those who tolerate them in the name of cultural relativism. And I sometimes think the most potent opposition to the movement will arise from the fringes of society, perhaps even from the evangelical tradition itself. Karl Popper, in The Enemies of the Open Society, wrote, "Unlimited tolerance must lead to the disappearance of tolerance. If we extend unlimited tolerance even to those who are intolerant, if we are not prepared to defend a tolerant society against the onslaught of the intolerant, then the tolerant will be destroyed, and tolerance with them. In this formulation, I do not imply, for instance, that we should always suppress the utterance of intolerant philosophies, as long as we can counter them by rational argument and keep them in check by public opinion, suppression would certainly be most unwise. But we should claim the right to suppress them, if necessary, by force, for it may easily turn out that they are not prepared to meet us on the level of rational argument, because it is deceptive. And they may teach their followers to answer arguments by the use of their fists and pistols, and we should therefore claim in the name of tolerance the right not to tolerate the intolerant. We should claim that any movement preaching intolerance places itself outside the law, and we should consider incitement to intolerance and persecution as criminal, in the same way as we should consider incitement to murder or kidnapping or the revival of the slave trade as criminal. We must begin to support these isolated groups and individuals, including those here tonight, who at some cost are fighting back, the clergy and rabbis who have banded together in Ohio to challenge in court the tax-exempt status of the megachurches that peddle this ideology and promote Christian candidates, the beleaguered independent judges such as the Republican-appointed judge in Dover, Pennsylvania, who banned the teaching of creationism in the public school because it is mythology, not science, as well as Cardinal Roger Mahoney, the head of the Archdiocese of Los Angeles, the nation's largest, who called on Catholics to be prepared to defy efforts in Congress, backed by the Christian right, to make it a felony to shield or protect or offer support to illegal immigrants. This bill before Congress would expand the definition of alien smuggling to theoretically include working in a soup kitchen, driving a friend to a bus stop, or caring for a neighbor's child. It would make mercy, compassion, and charity for the least among us a federal crime. In Mark Twain's book, The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn, it ends with Huck facing the moral dilemma we face, whether to pay homage to a false moral code that has become the law of the land, or damn ourselves in the eyes of many by opposing it. So I was full of trouble, full as I could be, and didn't know what to do. At last I had an idea, and I says, I'll go and write the letter and then see if I can pray. Why, it was astonishing the way I felt, as light as a feather right straight off, and my troubles all gone. So I got a piece of paper and a pencil, all glad and excited, and sat down and wrote, Miss Watson, your runaway Negro Jim is down here 2 miles below Pikesville, and Mr. Phelps has got him, and he will give him up for the reward if you send Huck Finn. I felt good, and all washed clean of sin. For the first time I'd ever felt so in my life, and I knowed I could pray now. But I didn't do it straight off, but laid the paper down and sat there thinking. Thinking how good it was all this happened so, and how near I come to being lost and going to hell. And went on thinking. And got to thinking over our trip down the river. And I see Jim before me all the time, in the day and in the nighttime, sometimes moonlight, sometimes storms, and we are floating along talking and singing and laughing. But somehow I couldn't seem to strike no places to harden me against him, but only the other kind. I'd see him standing my watch on top of his'n instead of calling me so I could go on sleeping, and see how glad he was when I come back out of the fog and when I come to him again in the swamp up there where the feud was and such like times, and would always call me honey and pet me and do everything he could think of for me, and how good he always was. And at last I struck the time I saved him by telling the men we had smallpox aboard, and he was so grateful and said I was the best friend old Jim ever had in the world and the only one he's got now. And then I happened to look around and see that paper. It was a close place. I took it up and held it in my hand. I was a-trembling, because I'd got to decide forever betwixt two things, and I knowed it. I studied a minute, sort of holding my breath, and then says to myself, all right then, I'll go to hell, and tore it up. I do not deny the right of these Christian radicals to be, to believe and worship as they choose. But I will not engage in a dialogue with those who deny my right to be, who delegitimize my faith and denounce my struggle before God as worthless. All dialogue must include respect and tolerance for the belief, worth, and dignity of others, including those outside the nation and the faith. When this respect is denied, it is no longer a difference of opinion. It is a fight for survival. This movement seeks, in the name of Christianity and American democracy, to destroy that which it claims to defend. I do not believe that Americans will inevitably become a fascist state, or that the Christian right is the Nazi Party. But I do believe that the Christian right is a sworn and potent enemy of the open society. Its ideology bears within it the seeds of a religious fascism. In the event of a crisis, in the event of another catastrophic terrorist attack, an economic meltdown, a huge environmental disaster, the movement stands poised to ruthlessly reshape America in ways that have not been seen since the nation's founding. All Americans, not only those of faith, must learn to speak about this movement with a new vocabulary, to give up passivity and to defend tolerance. The attacks by this movement on the rights and beliefs of Muslims, Jews, immigrants, gays, lesbians, women, scholars, scientists, those they dismiss as nominal Christians, and those they brand with the curse of secular humanist, is an attack on all of us, on our values, our religious freedoms, and our democracy. Tolerance is a virtue, but tolerance, coupled with passivity, is a vice. Thank you.